My name's John Allred, and I am an alcoholic. Did you get a little nervous when I went here? Yeah. A little serenity tester. I like to do that. I like to get out there on that freeway, you know, and find one of those cars with the Easy Does It bumper sticker and cut them off. You find out real quick which step they're working when you do that. I think most of them work in step one because I'll flash one finger at you when you do that. Yeah. I'm glad to be here. Last week we talked about the problem, really. Step one identifies the problem, that we're alcoholic and can't manage our own lives. And if I buy into the concept that alcoholism is a disease, you know, that disease has symptoms, can be treated but not cured, if I buy into that whole disease concept of alcoholism, then what my alcoholic mind tells me is that AA's got nothing to offer. Okay? Because if it's a disease, then my mind tells me I need professional help. I need professional medical psychological help. Now, and I'm busy. I can't go to meetings every day. I'm a busy guy. And in fact, if I was going to design the perfect treatment program for the disease of alcoholism, I'd probably do something like a 10-day treatment program. I could do a couple 2-day follow-ups. Need to do that. It has to be medically supervised, not just talk. And of course, it'd have to have number one success rate in recovery. Nobody goes to number two. And that all makes sense to my mind until you understand the nature of the disease of alcoholism. And if you're an alcoholic like I'm an alcoholic, the book says the only shot you got at recovery is a spiritual awakening. That's it. They don't cut you any slack on that. You need a spiritual awakening. That means when you get to AA, you're spiritually dead. It doesn't matter whether you're a priest or a preacher, whether you teach Sunday school. You know, when you get to AA, you're spiritually dead and you need a spiritual awakening. That means God's going to be involved. And whenever God gets involved, miracles happen. Okay? Because God works through miracles. And there's no way to explain a miracle. You know? The very fact you can't explain a miracle is what makes it a miracle. If you could explain it, it wouldn't be a miracle, would it? It's the fact we can't explain it. That's why you can't explain AA. You know? Because it's a miracle. You can't explain it. I mean, think what would happen if Moses tried to explain his miracles. You can't see that. Moses got the children of Israel. They've been held captive down in Egypt for 267 years. A lot of people didn't know that. I know that. So Moses, the great deliverer, he's going to take him out of Egypt back to the promised land. Right, y'all saw that movie? I know you didn't read the book. Okay. So Moses gets the children of Israel, they're going back to the promised land, right? They stopped at the Red Sea. Now they don't know how to cross the Red Sea. They're talking about it. They don't know whether we're going to build a boat across this thing, we're going to walk around, how are we going to cross this Red Sea? They don't know how to cross it. And all of a sudden the people come running up to Moses and say, Moses, we've got a major problem here. Major problem. Pharaoh changed his mind. He's coming to get us. What are we going to do? Moses says, I don't know. He says, I'll go talk to God, find out what God wants to do. So Moses goes, talks to God. He comes back in. He goes into his tent. He's got his consultants in there. Now, he's got his consultants. He's got his medical consultant. You've got to have your psychiatric consultant. You've got to have your legal consultant. You've got to have your engineering consultant. And, of course, you've got to have your PR guy. He got his consultants in there. And he said, okay, I've talked to God. Here's the plan. This is incredible. I don't know how it's going to work, but it's just going to work. I'm going to stand up on this rock. I'm going to take this staff of Aaron. I'm going to wave the staff over the Red Sea. And then I don't know how it's going to happen, but the Red Sea is just going to part. It's going to open up. It's going to part like that. And I know it's underwater now, but when it does part, it's going to be dry. And then all of us going to march through there. Now, there were 3,736,422. A lot of people didn't know that. All 3 million of us were going to march through that Red Sea. And then when Pharaoh comes out to get us, the water's going to fall down and drown them all. What do you think of the plan? Can't you see those consultants sitting there? That medical consultant says, oh, God, Moses, don't do it. Don't do it, Moses. Moses, we get a lot of old people. A lot of old people with us. These old people, they got asthma. Okay? I don't care if it's going to be dry ground. You stack that water up, you make the march through, it's going to be humid in there. That asthma's going to flare up. Moses, rotten plan. Don't try, Moses. We'll lose a lot of those old people. Psychiatric consultant says, Moses, terrible plan. Terrible. Forget about those old people. Hell, they're going to die anyway. Okay? We got a lot of youngsters here. We got a lot of youngsters, these little babies here, these young kids. Do you realize the psychological trauma? You stack that water up, you force them to march through there, that water stack, that's going to traumatize them. That'll scar them emotionally forever. Hell, what? Former adult children, Moses, she's escaping through the rest of their lives. Moses, it's just a rotten plan. Don't even try, Moses. Legal consultant says, Moses, don't do it. Terrible plan. Other side of the Red Sea, that's a foreign country over there. We got immigration problems. We can't do it, Moses. Terrible plan, Moses. The engineering guy says, Moses, rotten plan. Don't drop. You know how many pounds per square inch you start stacking that water up like that? That'll work. Only guy on Moses' side, public relations guy. He says, Moses, baby, love that plan. Love the plan. You pull that off, I can promise you 5 pages of Genesis. Well, how are you going to explain a miracle? You can't explain it. How's that work? That's why you can't explain AA. We tried to explain AA, but we can't do it. I mean, you go to work tomorrow. Those of you got jobs. And they'll say, did you have a good night? Oh, yeah, I had a great night, man. What'd you do? Well, you know, I went to AA, man, AA. Really? Yeah, okay. I went down there. It was really, you wouldn't believe it, man. This guy down there, man, he was doing real good. And he had a wife and family and business going and making some money. And then he got drunk and he got alcoholism and he got drunk and he got in all kinds of trouble. He lost his business, lost his wife, lost his house, lived outdoors, kept breaking the law, writing hot checks, ended up in the state penitentiary. God, it was great. They say, you active in that deal? Oh, yeah. Got a sponsor and everything. Who's your sponsor? Can't tell you. Mom just spoke. A lot like the guy that spoke, though. You know, he was doing good, and then he got drunk, man. He got drunk, he lost it all. He lost his business, lost his wife, lost his family. Went to the penitentiary for 2 years. Got out, never did get sober down there. Kept writing a lot of hot checks. Finally ended up out in the state mental hospital in Terrell. That's my sponsor. And I listened to every word he says, right? Think about who you're listening to as your sponsor. Crazy. Crazy guy. Or as you listen to him, you're crazier than he is, you know. Yeah, but how's that all going to work? You know, it does, but we don't know how that happens. You know, how we're restored to sanity. And I had a problem with step two. I'd go to these meetings on step two, being restored to sanity. And I think, I went to my sponsor, and I said, how do you take step two? And he smoked a cigarette for a while, and he said, well, I think we found it best if you'll come to believe that a power greater than yourself will restore you to sanity. I said, okay, I know that's what the step says, but how do you take step two? And he smoked a cigarette for a while, and he says, we really think it's best that you, when you come to believe that a power greater than yourself will restore you to sanity. And I thought, jeez, I'm going to have to help this guy, help him help me with the steps. That's all there is to it with this thing. So I said, you know, Don, I said, I was in a meeting, it was a step two meeting, discussion meeting, and this girl shared in the meeting what her sponsor had her do. And what her sponsor had her do is her sponsor had her take a piece of paper and write down all these characteristics of the old God she had. And this old God she had was a very judgmental God, a very scorekeeping God, a very vengeful God, you know, and big man up in heaven keeping tabs, keeping score on you, and it wasn't right. You were way in the hole on that thing. That's the kind of God she had. She wrote down all these things. And then she took another piece of paper out and she wrote the characteristics of the new God she wanted to have. And the God she wanted to have was a very all-loving God, all-powerful God, omnipotent God, all-forgiving God, all-merciful God. That's the kind of God she wanted. And then she had two gods there. She took the old God, this judgmental guy, and burned him up. And then she had her new God. I said, you think I should do that? And he smoked a cigarette for a while. He said, well, if you got nothing to do this afternoon, it won't hurt, you know. But he said, we've really found it best, John, if you'll come to believe that a power greater than yourself will restore you to sanity. And then he explained to me, he said, John, see what they've done. When you read these steps, just read the dark spots. There ain't nothing between the lines. We've looked at the black light and everything. Ain't nothing between the lines. And that step two is just the first step where it talks about faith. And I said, what's faith? And I said, oh, faith is a strong belief. And he said, yeah, that's one definition of faith, but let's use that definition in the Carpenter's big book. And in that book, it says that faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. I said, okay. And he says, and what does that mean? I said, I don't have a clue what that means. And he says, the substance of things hoped for. If you'll come, did you ever see an ad in the newspaper for Sears? And it says, come and save. I said, yeah. And if you go down to Sears on that particular day in that department where the ad was, and you ask somebody down to shop, what are you doing out here? They say, well, they got an ad going to sell one. I came to save. Yeah. Step two is an invitation for you to come to AA, to believe in a power greater than yourself that restores you to sanity. So if you'll come to AA and sit your butt in that chair, the first thing that will happen is you'll start to hear things you hope are true. Substance of things hoped for. People will share stuff, what God did for them, what happened, how they got here. And you're like, man, I hope that's true. Because if God can do it for men, maybe he can do it for me. Substance of things hoped for. You'll hear things you hope are true. If you stick around long enough, you'll see evidence that they are. See, we're all evidence of a higher power. Think what we get to see every day. How did we get here, man? We crawl in here. Nothing. Bankrupt in every department. No place to live. No car. No job. Nobody likes us. Nothing. Just bankrupt in every department. And what happens? Well, we don't drink. We come to meetings. And pretty soon things start to work out. You know, evidence of things not seen. See, I can see God working in your life a lot easier than I can see him working in my life. I don't see him doing much in my life at all. But I see him working in your life. Very short time. This guy comes in with nothing, man. He's got no place to live or anything. And in a few months, man, his whole life starts to get put back together. Just because he's doing the things in this program that we're taught to do. Evidence of things not seen. See, I've never seen God. But I see evidence in you that he exists. Substance of things hoped for, evidence of things not seen. And see, what happens when you don't go to meetings? You ever do that? I haven't been to meetings for a while. You're crazy, man. You got all kinds of problems going on. You call your sponsor just nuts. You know? And you say, I need to talk to you. And the sponsor says, okay, I'll meet you at the meeting. We'll talk after the meeting. Okay, great. So you come up to the meeting. Have a meeting after the meeting. The sponsor comes up and says, so what's going on? Nothing. Why? Well, you know, you're calling me. You were crazy. Oh, yeah. I don't know. It'll work out. You know? What happened? You're okay. You know? You quit going to meetings, you just go nuts. Go to meetings, you're okay. And we don't know what happens in here. We don't have a clue what goes on in here. But it always happens. Even the old-timers don't know what goes on in here. You know, but you ever see that, those old-timers? That are sitting, you're sitting around a newcomer's meeting, and this newcomer's sharing. Week sober. And he's crying, all torn up. He says, a week ago tonight, I was in a hot tub, 5 naked women, all the booze I could drink. And some old timer chimes in and says, you never have to live like that again. See, we got a buck for you here. And the newcomer says, oh, thank God. How's that work? What happens with that? We don't know what happens. Even after the meeting, you don't know what happened in the meeting. You're going home from the meeting. You had a great meeting. You're going home. You get there. You stop on the way home. Get Coke or something. Get gas. And you go into the little store there. And somebody's from the group in there. Wasn't at the meeting. And they said, hey, did you go to the meeting? Oh, yeah, man. It's a great meeting. It was a great. You missed a great meeting. Should have been this great. Really? What did they talk about? God, it was a great meeting. You just missed a good meeting. Should have been there. Who spoke? You should have been there. It was a good meeting. Great meeting. Something happens in here. We don't know what it is, but it happens. And you don't go to meetings. What happens? You don't go to meetings for a while. What do? You go nuts. Go to a meeting. You're okay. You're restored to sanity. So this stuff isn't real complicated. You want to take step two? Just go to a meeting every day. You know? And you're restored to sanity because it builds your faith. Because you hear things you hope are true and you see evidence that they are. Which is the foundation of faith. Which is what step two is all about. And so I was going to a meeting every single day. And I'm out in Reno, Nevada. I'm going to these meetings. I'm working the steps with my sponsor. And took step three on my knees with my sponsor. And turned my will and my life over to the care of God. And it was a great, it was a good time. I don't recall it as being an earth-shaking, monumental experience in my life. But I do remember as I kneeled down there, there were three little things that I knew God wasn't interested in. And these weren't big things. They were just little things. One thing, I knew God is not interested in money. God doesn't care how much money you got, because He loves the rich and the poor, right? He's no respecter of that. So if God's not interested in money, I'll manage my money. And the other thing was, God's not interested in employment. My mind told me that. I never asked Him, does God care where you work? I just figured it out. Okay? Because God loves He loves the bank president and the ditch digger, right? He doesn't care about that as long as it's honest work. So if God doesn't worry about employment, I'll manage my employment. And the last one was that I knew God wasn't interested in is God wasn't interested in relationships. I just threw that in there because I figured God's probably not interested in the same kind of date I'm interested in. Now, the real sad thing about what my mind just did to me when I took that third step is that whenever I call my sponsor, just crazy, over the edge, just in a lot of pain, the source of that pain has always come from one of three areas. And it's always money, employment, or women. Okay, and those are the three things I didn't turn over, because I'm in charge of this thing. You know? In fact, if you haven't figured that out, from now on, after you've taken the third step, after you get sober, you're only going to have two problems the rest of your life. And it's either going to involve money, or it's going to involve relationships. That's it. And if you haven't figured it out, employment and money are real closely related. Because if you got a job, you're okay. If you don't, you're kind of screwed. So get a job, you know. It doesn't matter what you do, just get a job. And in fact, I had to call my sponsor up, and it took me an hour to get around to the problem. I'd beat around the bush, you know, and finally get to the problem and before we could discuss it. So he said, we're going to color code your problem. So when you call up, I'm going to say, what color is it? And then you tell me, and that'll save us a whole bunch of problems. Save us an hour of your beating around the bush. So I had two colors. It was pink or green. It's either a pink problem or a green problem. And a lot of times the green really affects the pink. I mean, it really affects. So I'm living in Reno, Nevada, and I'm managing my employment by not working. I'm not working. I'm just playing poker for a living, and I'm managing my money best I can while I do all that, so I have enough money to play poker. And I've been sober about 3 months, and I fell in love. And this was the real deal, too, guys. This is beautiful gal. Beautiful gal. Picked her up in a bar. Well, the book says, you know, check your motives before you go there. And if you have reason to go, it's okay to go. And I had reason to go. And she's a beautiful gal. She was not an alcoholic, to my knowledge. She was a hypochondriac. And you know, they're a lot like alcoholics. They really are. But instead of going to the bar at night, they like to go to the hospital. I don't know what the attraction is to the hospital, but that's where they like to go, you know. Because every day we're taking this guy to the hospital, taking her to the hospital. Every night we're taking her to the hospital. Finally, we're down in the hospital, and the nurse comes out, and she's got a big, thick file. And she said, Val is very, very sick. And I said, well, thank God. We've been down here every night for 2 weeks trying to find out what's wrong with this guy. She went over a file with her. This gal had 17 operations. You know what my mind said? My mind said, this is great. This is great. I mean, think about that. I'm an alcoholic. I have a real disease. She just thinks she's sick. This will be really good. I'll get real active in Alcoholics Anonymous. She can get active in Hypochondriacs Anonymous. And we'll just get well together. You know, that's what we do. You know, we get these sick people together in AA. We get them all together here. We love each other, support each other. And we kind of just lift each other up and get well together. This will be just wonderful. You know? Sick relationships. Painful relationship. Oh, hurt. Hurt. And I didn't really even mind her five kids. Okay? Because it wasn't that bad, because she didn't have custody of all five, okay? She had three boys and two girls, and they took all the boys away from her because she beat them up, you know. And then I got a little concerned when I found out she'd been on 60 Minutes about this child abuse thing, but I didn't, you know. It was the real deal. I loved her. I just loved her. And my sponsor kept trying to explain to me, you know, that two dinglings don't make a bell. And we moved in together on the third date. And I called my sponsor up, talking to him about it, and it was just painful relationship. He said, leave. I said, I can't leave. I love her, Don. I love her. You don't even know what love is, you're so damn old. I love her. I'm not going to leave her in a time of need. I love her. You know, you don't even know what love is. He said, you can't leave. She can't leave. You ever notice you can't leave a sick deal? You cannot leave a sick relationship. You know? That's why it's sick, by the way. You know? He said, you can't leave. I said, I can't leave, Don. I love her. He said, you got a car? I said, yes, I have a car. So back your car up. Open the trunk. Put your shit in. Go. I can't, Don. Can't leave her, Don. Oh, God, a sick relationship. Painful. I should have drank. It'd been a lot painful just to drink. And I'm sober 11 months, and I'm managing my employment by not working, just playing poker. I'm managing my money so I can go play poker best I can, just save my money. And I'm involved in a sick relationship with this hypochondriac. And I'm sober 11 months, so I'm going to get my ear chipped in another month. And she kicked me out. She wasn't as sick as I thought she was she? What happened was I lost all my money. You know, okay, there you go. Got a green problem, text the pink. You know, I'm done. And so I had no more money. She kicked me out. I didn't have anything. I mean, I didn't have any money. And I slept in my car that night. Got up the next day, went in to see my sponsor at the intergroup, and tell him about I lost all my money, man. Don't have any money. The house kicked me out to sleep in my car that and last night. He smokes a cigarette. He says, thank God. I said, Don, wait a minute. This isn't just a little cash flow crunch you're talking about. They got to wait till payday, then I get a paycheck, I'll be okay. I said, I got no money. You know? And he said, thank God. He said, you've been walking here like a hotshot, John, for 11 months. Okay? Now, you get to find your source. It's going to take care of you the rest of your life. And I call that source God. This will be great. I said, okay, what am I supposed to do? He says, well, the first thing you're going to do is you're going to practice the seventh tradition in your own life. I'd only been here 11 months. I didn't know what the seventh tradition was. I said, what's the seventh tradition? He says, well, you're going to be self-supporting through your own contributions, declining outside help. I said, you've got to be kidding. He said, no, you don't borrow any money. I don't want to hear about you borrowing 20 bucks from an AA. You borrow 20 bucks from an AA, then you go get a new sponsor. Because that's not your source. You don't borrow any money from your mom. In fact, I don't want you calling your mom. You call your mom, she'll cry, you'll cry. She'll send you some money. It may kill you. Okay? So you need to talk to her. You tell me, I'll call her for you. Or you go to your sponsor and say, will you call my mommy? No, you're not going to do that. You know? So he says, you're going to get a job and be self-supporting through your own contributions. And the next thing is, although you're a bum, it is not God's will that you look like a bum. You're going to start to look and act like what you are, which is one of God's kids. So I had to shave every day. I'd sleep in my car, and I'd get up in the morning, I'd walk down to the Shell station, and I would shave and take a little sponge bath, and then I washed my clothes out I had worn the day before and put them in the back seat of the car to drive. And I had two outfits that rotated every other day. And I had to wear a little tie because I'm supposed to go out and look for work. And I said, what kind of work am I going to do? And he said, well, do you remember the last real job you had? And I said, yeah. He said, what'd you do? And I said, well, I sold insurance, and I sold real estate, and I sold equities and stuff like that. And he said, well, then you go to the insurance companies, and you go to the real estate companies, and you go to the banks and the mortgage and apply for a job. Bad deal. Don't do that. If you're new, don't do that. You've got to be bond to do any of that. And they got these big forms they want you to fill out. Ask a lot of questions. You know, none of their business. You know, they want to know like stuff like that first question. Address. They find no human license plate. You put a license plate down there, they don't know what that is. MD-237. Where's that? You know, they don't understand that at all. You gotta be bonded. It's just a bad deal, you know. And this was in 1982 in Reno. The economy was totally depressed in the country, and they just shut down two casinos, the Mapes and Money Tree in downtown Nevada, Reno, Nevada. Put 750 people out of work, and that's a lot of people in a small town. And there weren't a lot of jobs around. And I was looking for work, you know. And I went to my sponsor. I'm one of those little towns. I said, I can't find a job, you know, and I feel shitty. And he said, well, then go get a shitty job. And so I applied to be a cook's helper. And that's just a short form to fill out. They just want to know your name, basically. They can pronounce it, and then they feel a lot better about it, you know. And I'd go in there in my little tie, clean shaven, give my little card, and he looks at me and says, oh, John, he says, you know, I'm sorry, but, you know, I hire you. You're only going to be here for a couple weeks until you find a better job, and then you're out of here. I got to replace you. He said, we had a lot of Laotian refugees in 82 coming in, and he said, I can hire this guy, and he doesn't speak English. He'll be here forever. We'll have to replace him. I'd say, well, I'm thinking more like a career in the kitchen, learning everything about the kitchen, working my way up from the I just couldn't get a job. Couldn't find a job. And I used to walk around the casinos. I got down to 135 pounds because I wasn't eating very much. Wasn't eating at all. And so I'd walk around the casinos, up and down rows and rows of slot machines. And back then, when they were coin-operated, now they're not coin-operated. I'd starve to death now. But back then, and they'd put the coins in there, and people would hit a jackpot. The coins would fall down, and they'd scoop up their winnings and run off to cash in at the cash register. And they'd accidentally leave a quarter or a dime in the bottom of the slot machine tray. You could walk up and down rows of slot machines, and you can find money in the bottom of the slot machine trays. And I'd walk up and down rows and rows of slot machines. You'd make about $2 doing that. It'll take you 18 hours, but you can find a couple bucks a day doing that. I mean, if you got nothing else to do, it's warm, you know. Lady owned a bar, 751 bars on South Virginia Street. She was in AA, but she couldn't get sober. She kept getting drunk. But she let me save my life. Because she let me come into her bar on Friday, and I'd sweep out her bar, get ready for the weekend. And straighten up her liquor closet, and she'd feed me lunch and pay me $5, which I put in gas in my car. And that was the only meal I was guaranteed I was going to eat that week. And I was down, like I said, I got down 135 pounds, and it wasn't working. You know, I had I celebrated my first birthday, and none of my clothes fit. Because I'd lost so much weight that my sponsor said, you're going to that meeting in your pajamas? Because they were real baggy on me. And he said, yeah. You got to get some weight on you. And I said, fine, let me get a job first, okay? And it wasn't working. I'd done AAs because I know how to do AA, and there I am. I'm over a year sober, and I'm living in my car. I got no job. I got no place to live. I've got no money. I'm 135 pounds, and I'm walking the streets looking for nickels, dimes, and quarters out of slot machines, you know? And I was afraid. I got to be afraid. At times, I wanted to commit suicide. I got very depressed about it. And other times I'd be afraid I was going to die. You know, nothing insane about that, is there? And that would be like within a split second, I'd be want to commit suicide, and I'd think, man, I'm going to die. And I think I didn't mind dying. The fear I had of dying was that nobody would know. I mean, they would find, because I would die in my car. This is how I have a picture in my mind. I'm going to die in my car. And rigor mortis will sit in there, and I'll be crunched up in my car, and they'll say, here's a guy dead in his car. And they'll pull out and I had a driver's license then, but I didn't have any family or address in Reno, Nevada. Who are they going to notify? They won't know who to notify, so they'll just bury me in Pauper's Field, and no one will know I'm dead. And I told my sponsor that fear, and he said, so you're afraid if you die, no one will know who to notify. I said, yeah, how are they going to know who to notify? And he said, I can solve that problem. And he reached in his desk, pulled out a piece of paper, and he wrote, in case of emergency, call. He said, what's your mom's name? I told him, he wrote it down there, and her phone number, and his name, his phone number. And he folded it up, and he gave it to me. He said, now put that in your wallet. Now, if you die, they know who to call. I felt a whole lot better about it. You know? I carried that with me for 4 years, in case I know. In case I die, you know who to call, you know. In case I die, call Betty Jo. But it just wasn't working. And I'd go to these meetings, and I'd see other guys get sober, and their lives fell together. Some of them got back with their wives. I couldn't believe it. My sponsor told me, he said, you know, I can't promise you, a lot of people come in here wanting to get their wives back. And he says, I don't know if that'll happen or not. He says, but I'll tell you one thing. He said, we got a lot of guys in here that are married, and they keep screwing up. Maybe you can get one of theirs. So, But they're getting back with their wives, and they get jobs, and they got places to live. And I'm living in my car, and I'm going on 14, 15 months sober, and I'm living in my car, and nothing's working out. And it gets to be November, and it gets cold. It snows in Reno in November. And it's sub-zero, and my nose is running. I'm 135 pounds, and I think, I'm going to get a cold. And then in just a minute, it'll be pneumonia, because I got no resistance, you know. And I'm going to die. And I went out to State Hospital where I got my big book. Friday night, and I'm out there, and there's a gratitude meeting. Every meeting in November is a gratitude meeting, right? So I'm out there in November gratitude meeting, and I'm crying. And a couple guys had told me, they said, now, John, because what had happened that day? Let me tell you what happened that day. The reason I was crying is because I had had a ray of hope. My sponsor had told me, he said, I don't know how to live under the bridge. And so he explained to me that we can't help somebody do something we haven't done. You know? So he said, you're not to go down to the Dryers Club at 10 o'clock in the morning with all those other guys that are unemployed and ask them how to get a job. Because they don't know. Or they'd go get one. And so I can only talk to three people about my problem. I could talk to my sponsor about my problems. I could talk to my sponsor's sponsor about my problem. Or I could talk to his sponsor, which is PT, about my problem. Those are the three guys I could talk to about my problem. And he said that AA is not a dumping ground for your problems. You know, when you go to the meeting and they got a topic they're discussing, you share on that topic. If you got no experience, you pass. We don't come in there, I don't want to come in and hear about you whining and crying because you don't have a job and you have nothing to eat and be on the pity pot. That's not what we do in AA. Okay, we're solution oriented. We're not going to be a dumping ground for your misery. And but he did tell me this on Thursday. He said, now tomorrow, today's Thursday, you're going to the men's stag. He said, go out there and ask to talk to somebody after the meeting that's lived under the bridge and have them tell you how to live under there, because I don't know how to live under there. Maybe they can help you. So in that meeting, it got to me, and I just said, I got to pass, but after the meeting, I want to talk to some guys who lived under the bridge, because I don't know how to live under there. I'm in trouble. And they had their meeting, and after the meeting, good question, a lot of guys came up to me in that meeting, and they said, man, it's easy. All you got to do is go ahead and sell your blood. Back then, we got $7 for selling our blood. You get $7 for it, and at the blood plasma center, and then go over to the Social Security office and apply for food stamps, and you can give me some emergency food stamps right then. And then you can sell those on the street. You can buy food if you want to, but we all sold them on the street. And hell, you can have $20 by tomorrow night. I was so excited I couldn't sleep. You know? So I'd park around the corner from the blood plasma center. I'm going to be the first guy in line with blood plasma. I was actually third. There were two guys slept on the steps. And, so I'm the third guy in line. I get in there and sell my blood. They wouldn't take my blood. You got to have two forms of ID, and one of them has a picture. They want to know whose blood they're getting. And it's real tough now. And in 82, that was before AIDS. In 82, so it wasn't all, but now it's real tough. But back then, they wanted two forms of ID. One of them had to have a picture. And I had a driver's license, but it didn't have a picture on it. It was a special driver's license. It said right on it, special driver's license. They only give it to special people. Allows them to drive during special hours. No picture on my special driver's license. So they said, we can't take your blood. If I wasn't discouraged, I'd go to the Social Security office and sell my blood. They wouldn't take, or get my food stamps. They wouldn't give me any food stamps. Okay? See, they want you to have your Social Security card. I knew my number, but I lost my wallet a long time ago when I was drunk and didn't have the card. And I said, well, I know the number. What do I need the card for? They said, you need the card. I said, well, how do I get a card? They said, fill this out. We'll mail you a duplicate. Right, you're going to mail me a duplicate. How long does that take? He said, 6 weeks. It's going to be dead in 6 weeks, you know. I'm going to tell you, you got to be prepared to live under the bridge. You just can't go move out under the bridge. You got to have driver's license, ID, you know, Social Security. You got to have that stuff to live under the bridge. I'm prepared now. If I got to go, I can go. I can go to the scene. Well, I was very depressed over that whole thing. So I'm out to that evening, I'm out to the state hospital. I'm crying. My hope had just been dashed, and I'm going to die in my car. And I cried all meeting. And the gratitude meeting that time, they called me to share. And I was grateful that night for some stuff I'd never even thought about. I was grateful. I didn't grow up in an alcoholic environment. I heard, sitting on these tables, hearing some of the stories y'all tell about what y'all went through as kids. And I go through a lot of that. I was grateful for that. I was grateful that when I got divorced and we had a little custody battle for my children, I was grateful that the judge gave custody to my ex-wife. Very great. I mean, think, what would have happened if I'd have got custody of those kids? I mean, I can't take care of me. How am I going to take care of them? I'm living in my car. Very grateful for that. I was grateful for stuff I never thought about. And after the meeting, I'm getting ready to leave the meeting. And here comes Conklin. Son coming. Conklin was old money. Lots of family. A lot of old time family money. Son coming over to see me. I thought, it is about time. You know? He's probably so impressed with me, he's going to make me a job offer right now. He came up and put his arm around me. He said, God, John, he said, I love you. He says, I hope you really get an AA. I said, Conklin, I'm in AA. What are you talking about? He said, I know you're, but I hope you work the steps. Well, I said, I'm working the steps. I'm getting ready to take step 4. And he said, I hope you really learn to take step 3. You're not going to make it. I said, I've taken step 3. I took step 3 with my knees, with my sponsor. You know, Don, go ask him. He said, John, I don't want to offend you. That's not my purpose here. I love you. But let me tell you why I know you haven't taken step 3. Step 3 says that we made a decision to turn our will and our life over to the care of God. That means from that point on, God is going to take care of you. And the reason I know you haven't taken that step is because God takes better care of His children than the way you're living. Well, how could I argue with that? You know? It cut me like a knife. It's true. God wasn't taking care of me. So if God's not taking care of me, who's taking care of me? I said, well, Conklin, how do I do that? And he said, oh, you can't. I said, thanks for sharing. You know? And he said, see, John, until you accept your life, that your life is just the way God wants it right now. Your life is perfect right now. You're right where you're supposed to be, whether you know it or not, right now. Until you accept that fact, you can't turn it over. Because you try to fix it, don't you? You try to adjust it, you try to manipulate it, try to get it just right so it's okay. But if it's okay, you can quit messing with it and you can surrender it. So you got to realize that your life is, you're right where God wants you to be right now. You're right where you're supposed to be right now. If you were supposed to be somewhere else, you'd be somewhere else. If you're supposed to be doing something else, you'd be doing something else. He said that once you accept the fact that your life's the way it is, then you can surrender and turn it over to God. And then He can take care of it. But until you accept it, you know. And then you got to quit praying. You praying for stuff? Is it praying for stuff? He said, yeah, you praying for stuff? It's like you praying for a job? I said, well, of course I'm praying for a job. He said, you don't need to pray for a job. You don't think God knows you need a job? If He doesn't, you better get a new God. Are you praying for something to eat? And I said, yeah. He said, God knows you need to eat. Are you praying for some place to live? I said, yeah. He said, God knows you need a place to live. You don't think God knows that? He knows you need a place to live. I said, well, what the hell do I pray for? And he said, well, if you knew what God wanted you to do, without a doubt, God wants me to go do this. And you had the power to go do that. Don't you think you'd be all right? And I said, yeah. And he said, then you pray for a knowledge of God's will for you and the power to carry it out. And he said, if you can just do those two things, John, I want to promise you something. I want to promise you God will start to take care of you. And he made me a promise. It's the only promise I've ever gotten in Alcoholics Anonymous. I want to promise you that He'll start taking care of you and things will happen so fast you can't keep up with it. It's impossible to keep up with it. And I left there and I was staying in the MGM. In the parking lot of the MGM. Okay. I want to be honest about that. I'd park in the parking lot, and then I'd go in there into the casino. It was a big casino, and I'd walk around the casino till 4 o'clock in the morning because it was warm in there, snowing outside. But it was warm in the casino, so I'd walk up and down rows and rows of slot machines looking for nickels, dimes, and quarters, you know, till about 4 in the morning. And then I would go out and I'd go to bed. I slept in the front seat of the car. Somebody loaned me a sleeping bag. One of the members of in the group had loaned me a sleeping bag. I slept in the front seat, and it was a bench seat. I slept in there, and went out there and went to bed, and I was petrified. Because something had to happen. It had to happen pretty quick, because I wasn't going to make it. I was not going to make it. I didn't know what to do. And my prayer that night wasn't any great shakes. It really wasn't. I don't remember what I said, but I remember I was tired. I was exhausted. And I just remember talking to God and saying, man, I don't care, God, what you want me to do. I just don't know what to do. And whatever you want me to do, if you'll just let me know what I'm supposed to do, I'll go do it. I don't know where to go or what to do. And I need help. I don't know what to do. Just help me do. Just tell me what to do, and I'll go do it. And there weren't any bolts of lightning. I just went to sleep. You know, nothing changed. I just got up the next morning, walked down to the Shell station, shaved, washed up, put on my little tie, went over to the east side of Reno, I turned in some applications over there at a couple of convenience stores, and checked on those. Went to a meeting Saturday night at St. Mary's Hospital, that's downtown Reno, Nevada. After the meeting, I walked across the street, down the kitty corner is the Hilton Casino. So I'm walking around the Hilton. I'm not looking for a job. It's Saturday. I'm trying to stay warm and find nickels, dimes, and quarters in slot machines. That's what I'm doing. And about 3:30, 4 o'clock, I'm getting ready to leave to go out to go to bed. And I got a job. 4 o'clock in the morning, I got a job. Best job I could have got. Paid me $4 an hour and one meal a day. Best job. I don't care if I got a job, paid me $10,000 a month. You got to work a couple weeks to get a paycheck, right? But I got $4 an hour and one meal a day. So I got to eat every day. Best job I could have got. And I worked graveyard shifts, so I went to work Sunday night, worked from Sunday at midnight till 8 o'clock Monday morning. Worked that night, got to eat. 8 o'clock come, got off work, ran across down to the intergroup. See my sponsor, tell him I got this job. And we're sitting there drinking coffee, and I'm talking about his job and everything. And we're crying a little bit, and he's laughing, crying a little bit. And phone rings, about 9:30, phone ring, intergroup. He answers the phone, long pause. He says, yes, I know him, another long pause. He says, well, he's sitting right here, wait a minute. Handed me the phone. I took the phone, and it was a guy named Humphreys. Doc Humphreys is a medical doctor, lives next door to my parents in Utah. And I said, what are you doing calling me, Humphrey, Doc? And he said, well, I was talking to your folks over the weekend. Your mom's worried sick about you. I hadn't heard from you in months. He said, I couldn't call her, you know. And they're telling me about you, hadn't heard from you. She's worried sick about you. And I said, well, where is he supposed to be? And he said, well, last we heard he was in Reno. He said, well, I'm going to be in Reno tomorrow. He said, I'll just call the cops, see if they've got him. And they said, no, we've already called the cops. They don't have him, you know. But call AA. He's supposed to be in AA. Maybe AA knows where he is. So he said, I got in town that. Call AA, and hell, there you are. I said, yeah, I'm sober. And he said, well, you working? I said, sure, I got a job at the Hilton. You know. He said, great. He said, where are you living? I said, well, I'm moving. You know. We just want to tell him how bad it is. We just can't tell him how bad it is. And he said, have you signed the lease? And I said, no, probably going to sign one pretty quick. And he said, well, don't. See, although he's a medical doctor, he no longer practiced medicine. He was a contractor. He built homes and subdivisions. And he said, I'm building a subdivision instead. Instead, it's 8 miles north of Reno. And he said, built a lot of homes out there. Sold a lot, got a lot more to sell. And he said, but I've sold a house to a guy that I think is somebody stealing from me. Every week. I lose lumber and dishwashers and supplies and stuff from the houses that aren't finished. And I think I know who it is. And I got a house right next to his I haven't sold yet. He said, if I turn the utilities on in that house, will you come out there and live in that house and keep an eye on things on weekends and night? I said, well, I'll come out and look at it. See, in 48 hours, God had done for me what I couldn't do for myself. He started to take care of me. Incredible. He started to take care of me. And that promise that Conklin made me that night's come true. You can't keep up with it. I moved to Dallas in February. That was in November. I moved to Dallas in February. My sister sent me a Christmas card. I called up and thanked her for it. And she said, you're working at the Hilton? I said, yeah, I got a job at the Hilton. And she said, how much are they paying you? I said, $4 an hour, one meal a day. And in 82, Dallas was booming. I mean, that was when the first time oil went up, and it was like 40, 50 bucks a barrel. And Dallas was booming. There were a lot of stuff in Dallas-Fort Worth area. And she said, you can do anything here for more than $4 an hour. And I said, I kind of like where I'm at. She sent me the classified ad section out of the Dallas paper, and it was bigger than our whole newspaper. It was huge, and I couldn't believe it. But I didn't want to take a sober geographic. I read that thing, and I didn't want to take a sober geographic. But I saw these job offers in there, or job ads, and I talked to my sponsor about it, and I said, look at all these jobs they got. I said, I got this job over here at the Hilton, but look at all these. And he said, what's your problem? I said, I don't want to take a sober geographic. He said, let me ask you a couple questions. He said, do you want to go out there? I said, no, not really. You don't want to? You got some girl out there you want to go see? I said, no, I don't want to. I don't want to go. There's no girl out there. He said, you have to go? You have to get out of Reno? You got some warrants out for you here or some problems here in Reno? You have to get out of town? I said, no, I don't have to go out there and get out of town. He said, do you need to go? Do you have some need out there that needs to be filled? I said, no, I don't need to go. And he said, it's real simple. If you don't want to go, if you don't have to go, and if you don't need to go, well, hell, then you can go. So I moved to Dallas. You'll never take a sober geographic if you pass that test, And I sold the car I'd been living in. I threw a rod through the engine, so I sold it for $500. And I moved to Dallas. I hitchhiked from Reno, Nevada to Salt Lake City, Utah in February. Because you could fly for $99 one way from Salt Lake to Dallas. And so I called you. I moved by UPS. I called UPS. I boxed everything I had in three boxes that I owned, and they shipped them to my sister in Dallas. And then I hitchhiked from Reno to Salt Lake and flew for $99 to Salt Lake and landed there February 1 of 83. And my whole life started to fog out real fast. And as I said, that promise that Conklin made me has come true. You can't keep up. A lot of times you'll hear in Alcoholics Anonymous, these two time frames. There's God. I know we're on God's time. I just wish God would hurry up. I believe in those time frames, God's time and my time. The difference is that God's time is a whole lot quicker. A whole lot quicker than my time. The problem is me getting in the way. And what I have to learn in the third step is to let God be God and me be His son and have Him take care of me. I don't have to tell God His job. I don't have to tell God what I need. He knows what I need. I have no idea what I need. Every time I think I need something, every time I think it's a good deal, it turns bad. When I think it's a bad deal, best thing that ever happened. So I don't know what's right or wrong with me. I know that God does. And what I need to do is let God be God and me be His son and let Him take care of me. And that's the whole thing that happens in the third step. And you can't keep up with it. It's impossible to keep up with it. God does not make you prove yourself. I used to think, okay, after I get good, I'm going to have to be good for a period. I got a probationary period I got to go through. I'll be good, and then I'll earn some goody points, As soon as I am ready, I get it. You don't have to prove yourself to God. He loves you because He already knows who you are. The problem is I don't know who I am. And who I am is one of God's kids. And He takes care of me. And we'll talk about the rest of the program next. Thank you.